Okay, today, as you probably saw in the bulletin, there's a number of subjects we need to talk about as a congregation, a number of things that impact us in one way or the other. And there's been a lot of discussions, a lot of things that rumble around about a lot of issues. So one of the things that we've decided to do is that we're going to take a series and a set of time and sermons and to address some of these issues from a Bible perspective, and what we need to, how we need to view some of these things and look at them, and what we as individuals need to do, maybe in our families or maybe as a congregation. So this is the start. The subject today I want to talk about is addictions as well as pornography. I won't dwell too far on it, and this is, can't be an exhaustive message either. I do want to hit a lot of the main points, and I want to hit a lot of the points that are affecting us as a congregation, head on and talk about some of these things. So addictions are a big deal these days. If we look at it even in the news, we see this come up a lot of times. Tiger Woods, Russell Brand, David Duchovny, all these people have come out in some way or the other and said, hey, I have a sexual addiction. Now, whether that's an excuse in some of these cases or whether there's really something going on there, the medical, the science, the clinical world has not necessarily deemed that sexual addiction is actually an addiction at this point in time. But if you look at the patterns that and the rituals and the things that take place in the process, we'll see that it is something that people are very much get entrenched into, addicted to, and it ends up destroying themselves and everybody around them. And so it's an important subject for us to talk about. And it's hard, though, too. This is a hard subject. Some of this will be difficult to discuss. Some of it, it's very important for us to figure out, though, some tangible things that way we can think about this and how we can move forward. So we need to jump into this. And if we look at the world today, it's all over the place. If you look at every second of every day, and these numbers are old, $3,000 is spent on pornography. Every second goes by. 28,000 users are viewing it, and there's 372 searches into search terms. Pornographic terms. So it's very, very rampant today. What's the average age of the first internet exposure to pornography? It's actually 11 years old. You look at the studies today, the first exposure to pornography happens at such a young age these days because it's so readily accessible nowadays. What's the largest age group that is into pornography? Age range? Basically the 35 to 49 year olds. Those who have money, those who have things and jobs and other stuff like that, families and kids and all the rest, this is the largest age group that is into pornography. And if you also then look at kids today, what percent of 8 to 16-year-olds have viewed porn online? They say it's self-admittedly over 90%. That's the ones that will admit it if you poll people. So over 90% of that age group has seen something at some point in time or another. What percentage of visitors to these adult websites are actually women? This is not a commonly spoken thing, but they say 1 in 3 visitors now to pornographic websites are actually women. So by far, when you see this problem, you see it in a group, it's with the men. But as we march along these days, it's important for us to have our eyes open too. That is something that is crossing over. And if you see things that start down this road, like the novels, 50 Shades of Grey and other things that kind of introduce some concepts that are very pornographic and very over here, we start to see it becoming a more accepted thing these days. So we find 1 in 7. Now, if we look in the Christian world, you know, who says that pornography is a major problem in the home among Christians? That's a full 47% of the people who will actually say it. It's a taboo to say something and usually in the organized religion or church. So 47% who are willing to open up about it say that it's actually an issue in the home these days. And a lot of times people in organized religion have some of the biggest problems, but declare themselves the most righteous. And so this is where we find some discrepancies as well. So what we see, those are only some statistics. There's a study out, a statistical study out by Covenant Eyes, and they have 2014 pornographic statistics. Some of these came, or most of these came from there. But if you look at that, it shows you all the studies that have been done recently and all the effects of it. And the Covenant Eyes is a group that's a Christian-based group trying to bring awareness to it and also help prevent this from happening. So they have some interesting materials out there. What is an addiction, though? There's all kinds of definitions out there. So I glom some together. This is by no means an authoritative one, but it's basically the idea is a recurring compulsion by an individual to engage in some specific activity despite harmful consequences. So they feel compelled. There's a compulsion that a person feels that they engage in some specific activity over and over and over again. A lot of times that is done to feel better in life about something, but temporarily, because there is an emptiness or a pain, or there is something that we all deal with, that people deal with, and it's a way to deal with those things, to feel better for a certain period of time, to where it develops into a habit or a compulsion. Now, bringing up pornography and some of the sexual addictions, but there are, this is a definition, but there are actually a lot of different types of addictions that are out there. You know, there's gambling that's out there. There is internet addiction today, phone addiction today. I wouldn't necessarily say those are on some of the same destructive levels, even though they can be destructive, as some of the things like alcohol, drugs, and, you know, pornography. Some of those things have very, very, very devastating consequences, but the addictiveness of things, and it's not just those things, even eating. You know, eating can be an addiction sometimes, to mask something, just to eat and to feel temporarily better about something. Alcohol is a big one. Alcoholism, I think, is super much on the rise. Even shopping. I don't know if you've ever been bored or this, or, you know, in a place in life and all of a sudden you just can't shop and you can't stop ordering stuff off Amazon because you can just click and it shows up. You know, or you go to the store. You know, there's, you think about some of those things can actually be something that, you know, make you temporarily feel better. And this is what a lot of the addictions are doing. They're temporarily making things feel a little bit better for a period of time, but they don't actually. And if we look at the cycle, there's a lot of different cycles that you can see out there. But when we look at the cycle of an addict, what they go through are a number of things. A lot of times things are triggered by an emotional trigger, and that's a key part of this whole thing. Emotional trigger could be, you know, bringing up something that's very painful from the past or from your upbringing. And a lot of times people have or addictions or maybe sexually abused in their youth or another time. It could be. Not saying it's every case, but a lot of times there's a pain or something like that, a traumatic thing that comes up and they don't know how to deal with it. And so they want to, this feeling, this trigger happens, and then there starts to be a craving. Then there's a ritual leading up to actually doing something, a ritual behavior, you know, thinking about it, obsessing on it, going over, and then actually doing the event. And you see this pattern can go with every addiction. And then the actual using happens. So temporarily they feel better. Then what happens afterwards is when the realization happens, whether you wake up drunk or what you actually have just done, there's a crushing guilt and shame that happens. And so when there's the shame, the guilt and those things that happen to a person, well, what happens is, man, I don't want to feel that either. So they do it again to feel better temporarily. And then this cycle is one that just spirals downwards. So when professionals look at this, this is what they see as a general cycle. You can see variations of pieces of this in different ways. But this is a general cycle of addiction. And it's a very, very insidious trap, because what I want to bring out today is how this is actually a tool, if we look at that, of something that Satan uses to trap people, to capture people, to keep people down, to hold them, keep them in bondage and in sin. And it's something that's very prevalent today. It's hard to talk about because it's a very taboo thing to admit, hey, I'm an addict. It's a very taboo thing to admit. But today I would really like to bring some awareness to the issue. Not so that we can get on to people who are addicts, but so you can be aware, how do we actually move forward with this whole thing? Because this is a matter of salvation when it comes down to it. And I'll show you this in a bit. To be able to handle and deal with these type of things. And so how do we get better at this? How do we get better? So if you look at this cycle, it happens. I need to feel better about, I'm kind of oversimplifying it in my words just for the sake of this, but I need to feel better about something, and I go through and I do something, and temporarily I do. It's, you know, euphoria or a great feeling or a high or a drug or numbing the pain with alcohol or whatever, but then you feel horrible afterwards, and then you want to get rid of that guilt, so you do it again and again and again, and it just spirals downwards to where you're stuck. So an addict, you know, is basically ends up in a place where they're stuck. So, this is a cycle that we go through. Sexual addiction fits this. Now, part of this whole process, too, with an addict, is the idea that an addict will actually disconnect and withdraw. So, here's a quote from a book called Out of the Shadows, Understanding Sexual Addiction. It says sexual, break into that thought, sexual addiction is parallel. The addict substitutes a sick relationship to an event or a process for a healthy relationship with others. The addict's relationship with a mood-altering experience becomes central. The main thing is this experience, not with you, people, not with other people, but the experience. Addicts progressively go through stages in which they retreat further from the reality of friends, family, and work. Their secret lives become more real than their public lives. What other people know about them is a false identity. And this is very common. You know, an addict will get further and further away from people and groups and things. And, you know, a lot of times people lose their jobs and things like that. And it's a very, very destructive, in a self-destructive way, type of a pattern that's sometimes hard to break out of. But the disconnecting of it is part of it, withdrawing and disconnecting. And we see this throughout history. In fact, if we turn to Genesis 3:7, right from the very beginning, this idea... In fact, is our addictions covered in the Bible? There is so much in the Bible that covers the concepts that are in and around and about addictions that it's amazing if you open your eyes just to see a lot of them. We look at Genesis 3, verse 7. This is back when Adam and Eve first started in the Garden of Eden. It says, "Then the eyes of both of them were open, and they knew that they were naked when they had sinned, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. And they heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. Then the Lord God said to Adam, called to Adam and said, 'Where are you?' And he said, 'I heard your voice in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked and I hid.'" Okay, this is a very, very common scenario. When you sin or start going down this type of a path, is you hide from others, you hide from God. You check out. You go to the side somewhere. And he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you should not eat?" And what we see here, from the very beginning of time, Adam and Eve, when a sin and a pattern and a lifestyle was started down like this, that was a sinful one like this, they covered. They hid. They didn't. They weren't honest. They were very much into covering. I know this is a physical thing, but they were covering. It's deliberately like that. And I think one of the things Mr. Armstrong actually understood these scriptures to also mean when it's talking about they were naked, they realized they were naked. This is a tone that was set from the beginning of time where things became hypersexualized. Like they realized, and it was overtly naked and overtly sexual is what he realized. And then they were kind of shameful about it and clothed and hid and etc. So we see from the foundation of the world that the overtly sexual concept has been there and started. And what happens is they start down a path and it's covering and hiding. And we see this concept in the Bible. So starting with Adam and Eve, they covered and they hid the same thing. And we see that disconnecting, this withdrawing, this getting away from people, getting away from God and other things becomes part of this. Okay, so you can see a big pattern that starts to go a certain direction. So covering, hiding, and Adam and Eve, they did it from the beginning. Now, something else that comes along with an addiction is any form of blame shifting, where the person starts to blame everything else. So, you know, I had a bad childhood. You know, I want to reconcile. She doesn't. You don't understand how demanding my spouse can be, right? It's hard. So I have to do this to feel better or to cope or... Anything that shifts the blame off of you, taking responsibility, even if it's slightly somewhere else, is part of this. You don't understand the pressures of work. True, work's hard. People have had rotten childhoods. All these things are true. But when it goes down a path like this and turns into an addiction and blame shifting happens, what's the problem here? Because this is part of fixing, helping, is to not shift the blame. Even in the slightest. I think sometimes, you know, you hear people do it in a big way, but I think the subtle ones are more dangerous. They're really slightly subtle ones. You know, I do all I can, but I kind of, you know, this happened. And I just, you know, you get to a certain point. If you ever stop it to where a person's not taking responsibility and they shift the blame, that's a big sign of someone who is not dealing with it yet. You're not taking responsibility yet. You know, or, man, I'm really changing, but the other person just won't let me up. They won't see it. Okay, that's another subtle one. I really am doing all I can, but they're just not letting me up. You're still shifting the blame to somewhere else. And Adam said, it's the woman you gave me, right? You know, he did the same thing from the beginning. There's still blame shifting that happens. So we have this. We have covering and hiding. We have blame shifting that starts to happen. Now, what does this type of a process do to a person? It actually destroys you. It destroys you. So in Proverbs, there's a lot of talk in Proverbs that deals with addictions. It's a very fascinating book if you want to look at the principles of it. One of those is couched in the terms of a harlot, as in, and you'll see this compared to a lifestyle that's non-addictive to one that's addictive and that captures you like this, is a harlot, considered like a lifestyle. So think of it like an addiction lifestyle. Proverbs 6:26 says, for by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread. A lot of guys will say, hey, no problem, not doing anything to me, it can handle this. I can, it's not a big deal, or it's just this, or there's so many things that are said, but this says it turns a person or a man into a crust of bread. That's pretty low down on the strength and kind of things that you try to achieve in life, right? I don't say my goal is to become a crust of bread. That's the idea, is that you're just not even a full piece of bread, you're a crust of a piece of bread. It's deceptive. It reduces a man down to basically nothing. And then 1 Corinthians 6:18 says, flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body. But he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. It's very much clearly saying that it destroys you. When we're talking about an addiction, that's a sexual addiction. It destroys you. Like, this is the first place to start to realize. A lot of people think, and they wonder why, for men, this is something to think about. What happened to my strength in life? I don't feel strong and confident and everything else. Well, what's happening if there's anything like this in there is it's reducing you down to a crust of bread. If you want to think of a way to think about pornography and all these other things, is it goes directly against your strength in life, becoming a strong man. It reduces you down and weakens you to a crust of bread. So if you want to put it on those terms, sometimes people go, oh, wow, I didn't realize that. It actually destroys you down to nothing. So men, if you want to be strong, there's a reason to get rid of some of these things. That's how these things come. When you're in this, you think you're strong and you'll posture and you'll do all kinds of stuff, but you're not really there. So the first thing an addiction like this, especially a sexual addiction, does is it destroys you. It destroys you. Destroys you as a person. The second thing it does is it destroys your relationships. Here's some quotes from not somebody in the church, but somebody in a relationship with an addict. It says, I'll just read these. It wasn't until Miriam, PR marketing manager from London, moved in with her spouse that she began to suspect he had a problem. He would comment on women, either in real life or on the TV, if they were attractive or sexy, she says. There would be a sex-related, disrespectful comment right on the tip of his tongue, and he was never one to keep it to himself. So just the language and the verbiage around it. Living with him was incredibly detrimental to my self-esteem. One thing sex addicts can't do is associate sex with love. The worse he got, the more our sex life suffered. I think ultimately he objectified women unless he got to know them. As long as they were objects in his eyes, he wanted to sleep with them. Once there was emotion, care, and support involved, the attraction was totally different. But for her, there came a point when I had enough. I realized it was never going to change as long as he wasn't ready, basically, to change. And so in this case, the more he did and all these things, it destroyed their relationship, completely destroyed it. And that's just one kind of an example of a story, but this is one of the most detrimental things to a relationship you can have, even if you're not open about it. You hide it. It's one of the most detrimental things you can have in a relationship. So it destroys you. It can destroy your relationships too. Now, let's bring it back here. How does it destroy people or groups too? Okay? Here's one aspect of it. I don't know if this thing has a... Oh, it does. How it destroys people or groups. So this is not all inclusive, but this is something that I have seen, not just here, but I've seen this in every single church I've been in, repeated the same way. And basically the idea here is this. When you're an addict, it's a little bit hard to see. Sorry about that. This is a big red circle here. There's a hidden addiction that is actually destroying everything in life. So it's a red dotted circle because you don't see this openly. People don't show up and say this, or it's not well known. What a person will do when they show up is they'll present this public persona. They'll come and present themselves. What a great person they are. You know, I'm participating, I show up, I'm humbled. You present a public persona. Now, right in the middle of this stuff, there's a little bit of an overlap. And what's sitting in there is a lot of times there might be some marital issues that are real. Difference in personalities and other stuff that if you rank them here, they would be considered minor things. But those are the things usually that are brought out into the open and said, you know, when an addict is covering up and showing up like this, you know, will say things like, well, she, you know, does this, could be a minor thing. Or, you know, I really want to reconcile here these things, but she doesn't. And I'm just using this as an example. It could go the other way. But mostly in the church, it's this way, just to let you know. So she doesn't support me. And then they present themselves and their images a certain way. They show up as a certain way. They appear as a certain way. Now, spouse over here says, wait, but there's more, but I can't say. I'm not going to run this through the mud. But there is something behind that is killing everything. And so what do these people say? Yeah, you know these issues? I had them. I had these, you know, we worked it out. I had the same thing. We used to, you know, not get along and blah, blah, blah. And they'll say this and we'll work it out. But what is an iceberg underneath is never being addressed and is destroying completely. And a lot of times, here's how I've seen this transpire, is after X number of years, this person calls it quits and says, I can't do this anymore. I'm being destroyed. And when they get call it quits, then that person is blamed for not reconciling. So what we have building up in a group or people is walls. We have divisions. We have people saying, yeah, I agree with this, and this guy can't be bad. Right? He shows up. He can't be bad. I've talked to him. He couldn't. And I agree with these things. You know, I had the same problem. We should work that. You guys should work that out, kind of a thing. And then what we find is this is never addressed. Until that's addressed, this whole picture and this whole destruction of the relationship does not go away. For this to work, for this type of thing to work, this bubble has to be popped. Truth has to enter somewhere. Because otherwise you have sides get taken. People hear one thing. Are you going to hear everything that's going on in somebody's life? No, you're not. Some things are best to be kept private. They should be dealt with. And a ministry is involved in these things, but they are not going to be displayed out. When I say truth, it doesn't mean you go around and ask what's going on in somebody's life. I got to know every single detail. But for this person over here who's presenting themselves this self-deception and this false personality to everybody else, until truth enters that and pops that, you don't solve this. You don't solve it by all the little things in the middle, this kind of stuff. You solve this when truth enters in here for this person, and that bubble gets popped. That bubble gets popped, a rude awakening, and that person starts to admit and to deal with the hidden thing that's destroying everything behind the scenes. This is very, very important, because what happens, though? Here's what happens. This also happens in congregations. And I see this happen every single time. As soon as somebody starts to pop a hole in this bubble, that person gets mad and angry. Anger is a huge part of all this stuff. Anger is a huge part of addictions. When you start to pop somebody's bubble like that, they're going to lash out. What do they do when they start lashing out? They go find people that will agree with them. So very much so, you have a group. When you go find somebody, let me get somebody to agree with me. I'm going to keep you as my friends. You're my best buddies. You support me. You're so Christian. You've made all the difference in my life. Anything you can say, you have a group of people that support you. Anybody who starts to pop a hole in this bubble gets reamed, eviscerated, destroyed. Something, you know, and I've seen this happen. I've had it happen to me. When you start to expose that or pop it, then all of a sudden you get stuff that comes right back at you. So that anger and all that stuff, a lot of times the spouse knows and starts to try to do the same thing by popping the bubble. And guess whose anger gets directed towards them? Constantly. It's a very hard thing for a spouse. There should be some support that's given because it's a very difficult thing when this takes place to stand against that forever. It's very hard to do that on your own. And so that anger gets lashed out because that person's being seen for who they are. And they're not ready. If the person's ready to come out of an addiction, and there are people sitting here who have been ready and have come out of addictions, then they're ready to have that bubble popped. And they will go through it. And they will own it. But when that's not happening and you start to pop it, then boy, that anger comes out. There's big time anger that comes out. And the spouse, in this case the wife, had to deal with it for years and years and years. And finally says, I refuse to be destroyed. This is destruction. This is not even right, all of it. So this is one example, and it's very important to understand these dynamics, because we as a church, when we get to the end, we'll figure out what are some of the concrete things we do to help with this, not to exacerbate these situations. Because truth has to enter in this picture and has to pop this bubble for there to be progress and healing and things to be fixed. Otherwise, you have a wall, divisions, sides taken, and a whole bunch of talk. You can talk all day you want about this, but until this is popped and fixed, it doesn't go different. So it can destroy a group. And I've seen this. I'm not just talking about here, even though I've seen things here. In every church area I've been in, I've seen this exact same thing happen, especially, you know, and with addictions taking place underneath. Okay, so let me, well, I will go over a few minutes today so we can talk about this. I won't go over too far, but I will go over a few minutes. Now, let's continue on and talk about in the Bible. Let's read a few scriptures, because the Bible will talk about some of these very issues. And then understanding how the addictions are and how the process happens. Proverbs 7 is a great one. Talks about, again, the harlot and the lifestyle. Proverbs 7, think about this if you are struggling with addiction, you're in the audience, about this. It says, Proverbs 7, "And saw among the simple, I perceived among the youths a young man devoid of understanding, passing along the street near her corner. And he took the path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark at night." When an addiction starts happening and you read about the pre-rituals and the obsessing and the dwelling on it, that's what this is saying. It's saying the guy deliberately passed the street near a corner. He knew what he was passing. He took a path that went to her house. How many times did he do it? 3 times in a day. Twilight, evening, black, darker than night. The guy knows, obsessing, ritualizing, thinking about it, deliberately put himself there multiple times in front of it. Think about this for whatever you're thinking about, whether it's on a computer or anywhere else, that this is the type of a thing that you start to think about and obsess on. Now, what's going to happen? Is that just going to be like you walk by this stuff and it's going to ignore you? No, you walk by this stuff and it's going to catch you. That's what the next scriptures say. So she caught him. It's going to catch you. Kissed him. With an impudent face, she said to him, "I have made peace offerings with me. Today I paid my vows. So I came out to find you." I'm looking for you, buddy. "Diligently to seek your face." This stuff is going to find you. However you want to say this, however you want to think about this, whatever your issue may be, this stuff is going to find you diligently. It'll pop up, whether it's on a news feed or a site or an ad, or there's going to be things that will find you, come out to meet you. And if you find yourself, well, I'll just kind of cruise by it again, or this is what this is saying. Somebody devoid of understanding is going to just keep doing that. And it's interesting too, is most of it's done in the dark at night, not in the broad daylight, usually at night in the dark. So this will come out to find you. Proverbs 7:19. Notice this language: "For my husband is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. He has taken a bag of money with him, and he will come home on the appointed day." What is that language? The appointed day. My husband, he's gone. He's coming back. That's the language of Christ. Being married to Christ, he's gone on a journey, and he's going to come home on the appointed day. There's a period of time in life that we're living where this is saying, this is framing this in a much bigger spiritual context than you think. This is saying, hey, there's going to be this temptation to pull you down when you know your husband's gone, he's not in, you know, he's gone away, and he'll come home at the appointed day. This is actually a spiritual thing. So going on, it says, Immediately, he went after her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver. As the bird hastens to the snare, he did not know it would cost his life. His life. This will cost your life. This is a spiritual salvation issue when you want to talk about this. If you don't think it is, and it's something just part of society and other things, think again. This is what this is saying, that if you keep doing that and keep going, that there'll be a point in time where it's like, this will cost you your life. Christ is gone, will return one day. Where are you? We need to think about this a little bit more gravely than just, I'm a guy, this happens these days. This will cost your life. This will cost your life. Now, who goes? It says, don't let your heart turn aside to her ways. Don't stray into her paths. If your computer has a problem, don't go there. Don't stray into the path. You know how it goes. Don't stray there. For who has she cast down? She's cast down many wounded, and all who were slain by her were strong men. Okay? Her house is the way to hell, descending the chambers of death. This is an eternal salvation issue. Can you read those words? That's what that means there. Those who get slain by this are strong men, is what it says. Everybody I hear who says this says, I can handle this. I can do it. But strong men, quote unquote, are the ones who get slain by this. You can't handle it. You cannot handle this. Now, go back to Proverbs 5, verse 3. Same type of concept. Proverbs 5, verse 3. Says, for the lips of an immoral woman drip honey. Wow, this is appealing. Her mouth is smoother than oil. Oh, this is no harm, no nothing. Feels great. But in the end, she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. It seems great at the beginning. It seems nice. But in the end, it's bitterness. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lay hold of hell. Lest you ponder her path of life, her ways are unstable, you do not know them. How many times have I heard an addict say, I got this, no big deal. This says, her ways are unstable, you cannot even know them. This says, you can't figure it out. You don't have it, buddy, you don't. You think you're okay, you think you got this. You think this little thing is okay, but it's unstable. You do not know them, it goes down to death. Don't ponder them. Don't try to figure it out. You're not. It's going to destroy you. It's a spiritual issue. When you look at Proverbs, there's so much about this concept in there. There's a lot in other scriptures, but it's very, very, very blatantly clear. There's a lot of guidance in there. I'm only reading a few of them, but you can see this contrast that you'll see the principles that are there. So, we've identified the problem for the most part. How and what do we do to recover, to make steps forward, to go forward? Because this is important for us to understand. And it's going to be a process with these things. It's going to be a process. But how do we go forward? What's the road to recovery? Now, again, I'm not going to be able to cover everything in here, all of it. But I'm going to give you some of the main things here to talk about and at least bring some awareness to it. First point to understand is you must overcome. So point blank. You must overcome this. The Bible says, for sin shall not have dominion over you. An addiction, especially a sexual one, rules you. You're not ruling it. It's over you. God says, I didn't die. I didn't give you forgiveness for sin to have rulership over you, dominion, own you. I should have dominion over your life. For you're not under the law, but under grace. The first step is to understand is you must overcome. There's other scriptures that say it, and I'm not going to put them all in here. But you must overcome. If you want to think about this lifetime and you have a problem with that, that is something where Christ says to the churches, he who overcomes, that's one of the things that you have to think about overcoming. This is one of the things you need to overcome in this life. Now, it says you're not under law but under grace. Grace is going to be a part of this. Okay? For an addict, there's hope. You're going to have to ask for forgiveness quite a lot, probably. And this is where grace comes in. And I've heard it even said that grace is different than overcoming, or it's, you know, not the same thing. Grace is given so you can overcome. It's a tool for overcoming. This is what Romans 5 says. It says, when the law entered that offense may abound. It says, where sin abounded, whereas everywhere abounded, grace abounded much more. Even so, grace might reign through righteousness to eternal life. That's overcoming. That's life. That's forgiveness. That's repentance. This is saying that you have a tool that is called grace, that if you need a call on it, it's stronger than sin. There's no such thing as grace being at odds with overcoming. It is to help you overcome. And that will be required if you're into an addiction, so that grace may abound much more, so that you can overcome, that you can live, that you can have eternal life. You have to ask yourself sometime, do you want to be in the kingdom? Do you? You have to ask yourself that, because it's pretty clear what the Bible says. And I don't mean this to, like, in a bash or a shame. I'm just saying there's a point where you have to come to yourself to realize, okay, I need to overcome. I cannot keep playing around. I need to overcome. That's clear and simple. You will need to ask for forgiveness. You will get it. There is hope. God will forgive. There is healing. There are those things for you. There is nothing too much. That's what this says. Grace is more powerful. There is nothing too much. So that is a tool that God gives us that definitely will be needed. Forgiveness. Now, what else is needed? Popping that bubble with the truth is one of the biggest things. Until that false self of a bubble and the way you present and not dealing with it and blame shifting and covering and hiding, until that's popped, you will never go forward. John 3:20 says, for everyone practicing evil hates the light, doesn't come to it, lest his deeds are exposed. But he who does the truth, notice the truth is in here, comes to the light, that his deeds may be clearly seen. So if you're doing wrong, you know you're doing wrong, you won't come to the truth. A lot of times people won't approach the light, or when somebody's telling them what the light is. If I'm telling you this and you're recoiling at me, I'm not saying everything I'm saying, but if you recoil at somebody telling you the truth, that's what it's saying. You're resisting this. You have to pop it. Truth is the only thing that pops it. Christ said, you shall know the truth. The truth shall make you free. You are not free when you have an addiction. You think you feel good and all these other things, but you are enslaved. Christ says the truth will make you free. So that bubble is essentially a way to get you stuck into a place where you're lying to yourself and to everybody around you. Till that's popped, and until truth is inserted in there, this is not going anywhere. People do all they can to preserve that bubble. The way they look, the way they act, the way people, their people's opinion of them becomes the most important thing. What is my image to you? How do I appear to you? Is the most important thing. That has to be popped. Sorry, it's going to be complicated. I didn't say the whole church pops this, but it has to be popped with them somehow. Until this happens, you're not going anywhere. Time and time again. So when somebody is hiding and presenting themselves a certain way, and this is not popped, like I said before, they'll usually only hang around people that support them. If you're interested in popping the bubble, you will go to people that will tell you the truth. You know will be straight up with you and pop your bubble. Otherwise, you're not coming to the light. You're still hiding from it. You're still resisting it. You're not going to be healed. Okay? Who do you do that with? We'll get to that in just a second. Another thing that an addict has to do is to rebuild your core beliefs about yourself with God. God calls you, deals with your core beliefs. That's just what God does with us. He has a relationship, and he says, I know what you've been through. Let me rebuild that inside you so that you know that I care for you, I love you, and all these other things that are there. Core beliefs of an addict are defined, and these are some core beliefs. Basically, I'm a bad, unworthy person, right? They feel like they are flawed. Not that they just do bad things, but they're fundamentally, they are flawed. No one would love me as I am. If people knew what was going on, they'd be repulsed at me. So I keep it secret, false. And my needs are never going to be met if I have to depend on other people. I'm always let down by other people. I've tried relationships. They don't work. Every single person in my life has let me down in a relationship. So then sex becomes the most important sign of love. A recurring pattern of sex or sex or any addiction is my most important need. I'm not getting my needs met by people. So sex, repeating of it, or an addiction is the biggest need that I feel that plugs that hole up. These are some core beliefs that an addict holds on to, if you kind of want to break it down. These can be dismantled and rebuilt with God, torn apart, put back together in the right way. And we see in the Bible, you can see examples of things like this. The woman at the well is one of those, if you want to look at it. John 4, verse 5. Let me just read this story here. It says, he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour. A woman of Samaria came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone into a city to buy food. And the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." So he wasn't supposed to be talking to her. Christ reached out and talked to her. And Jesus answered and said to her, "If you had known the gift of God and who it was who says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him. He would have given you living waters." And then the woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock?" And Jesus answered and said to her, "Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give to him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give to him shall become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life." And the woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water that I may not thirst." She's still thinking physically. Christ is talking what? Spiritually, right? It's something that will well up and become eternal life. That's God's Spirit. "Give me this water that I may not thirst, nor come here to draw." And Jesus said, "Go call your husband, come here." So Jesus knew what was going on with this woman. So the woman answered and said, "I have no husband." And Jesus said to her, "You have said that well. I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that you spoke truly." Then the woman said, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." What we see here is an interesting story that if you want to think about somebody stuck in a cycle, it's an example of a cycle. This woman was. This woman was stuck in a cycle where she's had five husbands, and the one she's with now is not the husband. And the repeat cycle there is something in her that's not sorted out to where she's going to go through this pattern of husband after husband after husband here. Christ recognizes this is why he asked her, "Can you go get your husband and bring him here?" And she's like, "I don't." Now, what's interesting too, though, is if you look at all these, you know, the core beliefs of a person in a cycle like this, Christ deals with all of them. The number one core belief is, you know, basically, I'm a bad, unworthy person. He wasn't supposed to talk to a woman from there. You know what? He did not care. He took the time to talk to her and to give her a sense of worth. He's being straight with where things are, but he's reaching out to her. He's giving her, number one, a sense of worth that you're worth it. I'm not even, you know, they consider themselves low and couldn't be talked to, and he's saying, "No, I'm talking to you." And then two, he's addressing that there is a thirst, there's something inside of you that's not being addressed. If you drink of this, you won't thirst after those things, which is a huge key to us to think about when God is in the picture here. Christ is saying this, that you won't thirst again. When I say rebuild these core beliefs, these are the core beliefs that make people hunger for things like love and attention and addiction and drugs and things. They're hungering. So rebuilding those core beliefs in God and Christ is what he's saying here. You won't thirst if you rebuild them with me. Is that saying every person's an island and it's just, you know, pray and ask God and all of a sudden it's all taken care of? No, you have to rebuild those core beliefs. You have to understand how God views you. You have to know it, live it, believe it, trust it. Christ can reach out to you. You have to put away some of the things that you're doing. You have to rebuild those things. And when you do that, when you rebuild it, as God says, the thirst won't be there. The same thirst that drives you to do those addictions. Christ is saying, you won't thirst again. I think that's quite an encouraging thing. Christ saw this in people. It's a problem today, sure, but it was a problem then. It's been a problem through mankind's history. And Christ reached out, gave a sense of worth, said, here's what you need to stop doing. I have an answer for you so that you don't hunger and thirst after those things that are making you go do this kind of stuff. So if you look through the Bible, man, there's a lot of examples of things, if you want to pick them apart, that deal with addictions and dealing with the issues that surround addiction. So rebuilding us corporately. What else do we need to do as an addict? We need to take responsibility. So blame shifting. If you're blame shifting, even subtly, you're not on the right path. If you're blame shifting, even subtly, you know, I've tried all I can, but they just won't let me up. You blame shifted again. Just a little bit more subtle over here. Anything that takes it off you. If somebody's truly sorry as an addict, they will do all they can to make it better. They will say, I deserve this. If it's divorce, I will work. It's my fault. I will fix this. That's what you will hear if somebody truly is taking responsibility. How's that backed up in the Bible? This says it. 2 Corinthians 7:10 says, for godly sorrow produces repentance, true change, leading to salvation, not to be regretted, but the sorrow of the world produces death. For observe this very thing, that you sorrowed in a godly manner. If somebody's sorrowful in a godly way, what diligence? Diligence, I'll do all I can. It producing you. What clearing of yourselves? I will do everything I can to make sure this isn't part of it. Indignation, fear, desire, zeal, vindication. That's the language of somebody taking responsibility. Blame shifting, even in a subtle way. So if you hear somebody blame shifting, they need to be called on it. They'll never get better that way. They'll never get better. They'll never get better. Have traumatic things happen to people? Absolutely. But when you are in a scenario, it cannot be shifted somewhere else. You have to own that part. Healing can come for that part too. But you have to own where you're at. You have to own it. So responsibility is something that is required here. There has to be a responsibility that is taken place. Another thing is accountability. Galatians 6:1. This is talking about people connecting with people who are doing sins. If a man is overtaken in a trespass, you who are spiritual. So this is a spiritually mature person. That's what that means. If you think you're spiritually mature and you keep telling people that, you're probably not. So pass it off to somebody else. This is saying those who have had enough, you know, the experience, who are actually spiritual, can handle this kind of a mess. Restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness. Consider yourselves, lest you be tempted. Bear one another's burdens. The idea here that there will be some people that you need to help you through that. Accountability to other people is what this is talking about. And somebody spiritually mature enough to handle that with you is a very important part of this. A lot of people go off on their own and say, I've got this, they try it, they do it, but they're never willing to say, I need help. I need somebody to help me with this. Help me restore in this. Bear this with me. That's what this is talking about. There has to be accountability that's in here. Okay, so let's pull all this together. Let's wrap this up with three more points, slides. What do you do if you're an addict? So say you're sitting here in the audience and that is something that you're struggling with. Again, I'm not saying this to make you feel like, oh, it's just another, like, you're just, you know, everything's bad and we're condemning you. I'm saying this to bring awareness and also what needs to happen. First of all, the first thing you need to do at some point in your life is start with truth in yourself. Understand that that is a matter of salvation. Don't kid yourself. Understand the truth of the matter first with yourself. Go get help. Seek counsel. If you think you do it on your own, you can't. Go to the ministry. Ministry's dealt with it. I can tell you, ministry here is dealt in dealing with and or dealt with every single one that we know of at the moment issue that has happened around this. Things aren't just being dropped. These things are being talked, discussed, worked with, and dealt with. And the ministry has seen a lot of this stuff in over time. I've counseled with a couple people personally, too, over time. It's a very, very tricky thing to talk about and work with. Also, don't discount outside professional help. This is a very insidious thing, and there are people that have processes and things that they brought people through that can help you. It's not going to be everything. Obviously, your relationship with God and everything, but that is going to help. Don't discount that stuff. Don't discount it. There's people that do even support and addiction groups. People can knock them for this reason or that reason or say this. But how many have you helped rehabilitate? Probably zero. How many have they helped rehabilitate? Hundreds and thousands. There is something that is Christian-based and biblical that they do, including accountability and other stuff, that you can get out of those groups. So don't try to do it yourself. Don't. Just try to do it yourself. Seek help. Those you can trust. Confess this truth that you know to faithful friends who are of God and that will hold you accountable. I wouldn't say go tell the whole church at once. If you want to, one day you can. That's where you feel like. But I'm saying find people who will hold you accountable. Okay? Have and hook that person who's spiritually mature, connect and have them hold you accountable. This isn't to make you feel better. Make sure that you're doing the right thing. Then commit to being truthful. Start being truthful. Stop lying. You're kidding yourself. All these subtle little lies, especially things that make you look better and present better here. Just stop the lying process. It's part of it. There's a movie, I wouldn't recommend you see it because there's graphic things in it, just as a warning, especially not for kids, but it's Flight by Denzel Washington, where he is an alcoholic and he goes through this process and he gets to a point where he realizes, finally, it's a fascinating study in this very thing. But skip the first 2 or 3 minutes or whatever it is. Okay? And also, don't withdraw and hide. Get involved. Engage with people. Be vulnerable. Be open. It's okay if people don't think you're that great or something. Just be open and vulnerable. Get involved. Is this the comprehensive list? Absolutely not. I just want to give you some of the points that we've discussed today and some of the things to do. Now, what if you're in a relationship with an addict? What do you do? Well, if it's not going anywhere and it's years and years and years, confess the truth to yourself. Stop making excuses for your spouse like it will get better or I believe them this time. Get help. Come talk to the ministry. Let me just tell you this. If you come talk to us as a minister, I'm not going to tell you I have all the answers and may pair you up and find some people. Say, look, I need you to find, you can do it or I'll help you. Find a couple people to be accountable for. And I want you to go do this counseling too and we'll do this counseling. There is going to be a process to go through that actually helps you, that will be accountable and all these other things and go through things. Get help if you're in this. Ministry counselors, hold your spouse accountable. The excuses need to stop. What's really helpful sometimes, too, is to find a support group for spouses of that particular addiction. It's a very, very hard thing when you're in it to get outside of it. You feel it. It's hard to filter it. You feel, you don't know whether it's up, down, left, or right. A lot of times people blame them, and it's like, you know what? You've been dealing with such amount of lies and mixed things for so long a time, it's very hard to get out of it. So these support groups focus on removing the burden from that person and puts it squarely back on the addict reforming and what you can do to not enable those things. Okay, those are important things. Those are very much helpful. Don't give up on your church family, too, if they don't support you at first. I've seen this many times. They get turned on. They don't support you at first. Don't give up yet. Right? Give people time, too. You know, that takes time sometimes. Okay? Again, not a comprehensive list, but a start. Okay, this is a start. And lastly, how can the church help an addict? Well, let's talk about some things to do and don't do. Don't jump to judgment. You're not going to know the whole story. And you're not going to be told the whole story either. I can tell you that. Some things are just not going to be spread out everywhere. Talk to your pastor. I guarantee you, your pastor will know what's going on or has been involved, or one or more of the elders in this room will be involved with this or haven't been involved with this. Now, in many different levels, if you see people really making progress and trying in other things, they're getting help they need. There will be times if somebody refuses to see it or anything and they're just further dividing other things, we'll be asked not to come. Okay? This has to do with repentance and changing. If you're making that and looking for help. So don't jump to a judgment on these things. Don't jump to it. Don't take sides. Don't build those walls. Don't do all the kind of superficial things that look like it. Seek lots of counsel. Not from your friends that agree with you. That's not counsel. Counsel comes from a variety of people, and especially those that may not agree with you. But serious counsel. This is a serious issue. These are not light things. This is not something to just say, I have this problem like that. If you as a person can't discern truth and lies, don't get involved. You're going to hear all kinds of things. If you do not have the ability to be a spiritually mature person and discern truth in lies, do not get involved. Let me just say it that simply, because you'll only make it worse. Because you'll say, yeah, that sounds right, or yeah, this is a very tricky thing. Let me just tell you, well, the reason I'm addressing this is because it's very tricky and can divide groups completely. Something to think about. Understand the excuses they're going to make, but don't accept the excuses. It's important to know what's going to come out of their mouth and how you hear it. Showing love to an addict requires accountability, not empathy. You're not there to say, I know it's so hard and this and that. You have to hold somebody accountable. If that's you involved with it, that's what your role is, to make sure they're accountable to things. That's showing love. Anything else is enabling that person with a bad behavior. So we as Christians need to get better at this. If we are just, oh, yeah, I understand, and this, and you know, and that person knows you're on their side all of a sudden, will support them, you're enabling a bad behavior. If you're saying, hey, how's it going this week? Have you slipped? I'm here, you know, I'm here to, let's talk about this. I know it may be hard. The accountability has to be there for that. They're actually making a change. That's the role of a person takes in it. Be patient and encouraging. Yes, but hold a person accountable. If you're not, and it's just sides, you're dividing the congregation and enabling another person. Let me just put it as simply as that. So it has to do with making sure if you're involved and you can see what's going on, accountability. Realize you're probably in over your head. Seek wisdom from books and people. Talk to the ministers, talk to outside. Whatever it takes, realize that you're probably in over your head. There are people who have dealt with this for years. I know lots, there's lots of ministers. I know Carl Anderson has a lot of experience here. He's somebody who's dealt with himself, his own alcoholism, addictions, and with a lot of other people. There's some people here that have gone through years and years and years and see and know the patterns of this stuff. So seek the counsel and wisdom of somebody who actually has gone and seen some of those things. Okay, so that's a whirlwind tour. I took a bit more time. I think it's an important enough topic that we start to talk about some of these things. I think it's important to understand how they fit together. It's not an exhaustive thing. Should be an awareness that we start with today. We should be aware and know what to do, because working through this, the goal is to get a person and to be out the other side yourself if you're an addict. So if you are, please find a time to talk, find somebody you trust and go talk, start the process. Because the only thing that's going to make you free is the truth inserted and pop that bubble in there, inserted into your life.